The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to start this morning's talk quoting the Zen master Dogen as a way of saying in a very pithy way kind of what I would like to explore. He said, in talking about awakening or enlightenment, he said, ordinary people are deluded about awakening. Awakened people or enlightened people are awakened about delusion. And so, you know, enlightenment, awakening is often a great ideal. And there is no shortages of ideas people have of what that's supposed to be like. People have intuitive ideas, guesses, they read books about it. And so they kind of, people often orient themselves around some idea that, some ideal that they're supposed to reach and be or attain. And if only you could get enlightened and get the key to the kingdom, then you'll be happy ever after. Whereas this quote suggests the opposite. It's not a matter of understanding enlightenment, it's a magic world out there, or some inner essence of the mind or the heart or the reality or something. But rather, people who are awakened, what they awaken to is they understand really well the nature of delusion. And guess whose delusion? It isn't that, you know, now you understand all those people out there and you're going to tell them how deluded they are. But rather, is to understand yourself in some deep way. And so the study, the path of awakening and what awakening is a big part of it, is to really understand well the nature of your attachments, your desires, your confusions, the way your mind works. And so a big part of mindfulness practice and Buddhist practice in general is this turning back into your own experience to understand how it works, how you construct your experience, how you, your mind works, how you operate. And in particular, not to see that it's luminous and bright and awakened, its true essence, its purity or something like that, all these ideals people have, but rather to see how it, all its odd ways in which it works, all the ways in which it gets caught up in delusion or attachment or anger or hate or desire. Now, this is not meant to be kind of just endless bad news, but it's meant in part to be realistic so we can really understand ourselves well. We're not bypassing ourselves or overriding or pretending that we're different than we really are. But it's also so that when we understand ourselves, so we understand the nature of our mind, how it operates, so we're not tricked by it, not fooled by it, not pulled into it. So we can become free of the different games our mind plays. So a little bit it's like, so to take it from a different angle, we have the often used expression in English of thinking outside the box. And in a way, for this kind of practice of mindfulness, we are kind of thinking outside the box in that we're approaching our life in a way that's very different than how it's, the mind normally wants to approach its life or approach itself. And it might be useful to think of it rather than thinking outside the box, it's thinking outside of thinking. Thinking outside of the normal currents of the way the mind operates. And so how do we think outside of thinking? You know, if some people live in their thoughts, that's how they experience themselves, the world. It's inseparable, it's completely entangled, that how we think about things is how we relate to them. How, if I think it, it must be true. And if I think it, then I'm the thinker and all that. But to step back, mindfulness it uses the capacity we have for self-reflection. Human beings have a really amazing capacity of awareness, and in a kind of awareness where we can be self-aware. We can be aware of ourselves as we're being aware. We can know what we know as we know it. we can know that when we're talking to someone, I'm talking to someone. And because you can know that you're talking to someone while you're talking to them, you could track, it's possible to begin tracking how you're talking to them. What are the beliefs? What are the attitudes? What are the desires? What are the aversions that are operating as you're talking to someone? So this ability to be self-reflective, to turn back and understand what we're doing, is a very important part of what Buddhism wants to cultivate and develop. So if you start studying our capacity to be aware, one of the things we might become aware of sooner or later is how the things that we're concerned with, the things that we're focusing on and involved in the world, often operates like flypaper. I haven't seen flypaper in decades, but growing up, there used to be flypaper. They would hang it, these coils from the ceiling or someplace. And those poor flies, they were attracted to the flypaper and be sticky, right? And so they would get stuck, and then they go sticky enough they couldn't get away. So some of us have flypaper in our minds. And so meaning that the way that we relate to many things is we're stuck to it, we're caught in it, we're involved in it, we're entangled with it, as opposed to being somehow free of it while we're doing it. So our attitudes and our responses. So I'll try to give you some examples just from the last week for me of my study of delusion, my needing to wake up to delusion and attachment in order to be somehow free in the situations I was in. One was, I don't know if it's a good example, it just comes to mind. So I was on a little vacation with my 14-year-old son, and vacations are, certainly can be nice, and vacations can be other ways too. And so there are a lot of opportunities to study my reaction and response to different situations. So it was really hot. It was like in the hundreds where we were. And being kind of a little bit interested in the world of religion, I had booked us a kind of a accommodations in a convent that that had a hotel, right? I thought that would be nice, the nuns are nice. And I don't know if my 14-year-old was interested in that, but he didn't know it was coming. So it was fine, and except we checked in, and they said, "Oh, welcome! It's nice, and you're up on the third floor, and here's your key, and this is how it works. This is when breakfast is, and all okay." And then as about finishing up the check-in, she said, "Oh, and there's no water right now." So, okay. I've been to all kinds of monasteries and temples and all kinds of places where, you don't expect things to work so well. So that's part of the practice, part of the training, is to go to a Buddhist monastery as you kind of just work and are relaxed about how things are. Or you try to be relaxed. You try to work with that. So, okay, so this is how it is. Well, it didn't cool down much at night. So it was, I think by midnight, it was like 90 degrees or something. And there was no air conditioning because of the convent. And so it was really hot. So that's fine. So so then I got up in the morning and we had breakfast and went out went to the desk and said, there's still no water. And none, they were kind of implacable, it's like, maybe they were enlightened or something, kind of. No response. Go, "Oh, yeah." That's how it is. So I kind of appreciated that, because in Buddhism also there's this kind of, that's how it is. You used to be with things as they are. So she was that way, so okay, it was interesting. Different than how I would usually expect someone who's offering kind of hotel to be. So I thought that was interesting, and so I said, and she said, "Well, we can hope that," she said, "we can hope that it'll get better." "We can hope." And so I said, "Okay, we'll hope, we'll pray." So that was fine until I came back in the late afternoon. It was in the hundreds where it was at, so it was really hot. So came back, and any water? No. So so you know, what do I do? You know, what? So as I went through all this process, what goes on in my mind? So there was certainly aversion to the situation. There was some annoyance, some self-righteousness that arose, some ideas that, you know, these people should, you know, I deserve something, or I'm paying for this place. And there's a variety of reactions I had. Some of them, in some ways, might be reasonable to have, maybe not unreasonable to. I thought about maybe we should, you know, this is going to continue. We can't stay here. You know, it's okay for me, but this 14-year-old's not sleeping. And to have a 14-year-old who's not sleeping is is not good. And what I could see was that I could have those thoughts, but also I could be this like a flypaper. I was kind of caught in the thoughts, or I would see the world and situation through those thoughts and through those feelings that I was having. So I could see that, and I know there's a possibility of seeing the situation not through the thoughts and through the feelings, but apart from them, to kind of have a kind of bird's eye view of it, in a sense, to step back and see, oh, here I'm having these kinds of thoughts. Here I'm having these kinds of reactions and feelings. This is what's happening here. Now, one possibility is to see my reactions and say, Gil, you should be better. You should know better. You know, you practice all this time, you shouldn't be, you know, annoyed at these nuns. You shouldn't be, you know, whatever. But rather, the beautiful thing about this capacity for self-reflection is to just see it without judgments about it, without needing to have interpretations of it. Oh, here I'm having these thoughts. I'm annoyed. Here I'm concerned. I have worry. This is what's going on now. And to see it from a corner of the mind, or a place in the mind, perhaps a higher functioning aspect of the mind, that can see it without further reactions. This is how it is right now, just like this. This is what's happening here. And in there is where I found my freedom. We could see it, and I had to do it repeatedly, because it continued, the situation, right? But I would watch and track myself and see these different reactions and thoughts that I had, and I would see it clearly and mindfully. I'd be really mindful. This is what's happening now. And in that clear, this is what's happening now, I found my freedom. So this is where you're awakened to delusion. It wasn't that I was kind of floating on a cloud and everything was fine. And it's all okay. Water, nuns, no nuns. It's all, you know, it's all beautiful. And, you know, that was just kind of like, you know. It wasn't that way at all, but rather it was, you know, I had my reactions and responses, but I also could be free of it. Which gave me the... So you might think that then I was a pushover. Maybe I was. But what it allowed me to do was to then decide more wisely, what should we do in this situation? I was able to kind of approach the problem-solving part of it, and I felt in a much more balanced, relaxed way, more realistic way. Because I could see that if I got pulled into this, the flight paper or the stickiness of those thoughts or those feelings... If they started to get the feelings, the emotions had the upper hand, then I wouldn't think so clearly. But if I could be free of them, I could be informed by them, I could learn from them, because some of them are useful to pay attention to, but I could make the decision from another part of the mind. And, you know, there's all these different parts of the mind. Mind is like a city. And so what part of the mind do we allow to make our decisions is an important question for all of us. So another example of this was maybe, I was traveling and I came back and I had jet lag and or whatever and time change, and during the vacation we didn't sleep very much. So I don't know all the reasons for it, but maybe I don't have to know the reasons, but I came back, and then the day after I came back, in the morning, I had a really strong headache. And so, so the mindfulness, right? So watch what's going on for me with a headache. And I could see there, too, there's a sticky paper operating. All these thoughts, the feelings, the pain itself that I had, I was reacting or responding through the pain or with the pain, kind of being oppressed by the pain and thinking through that, thinking with the oppression. And and having all kinds of judgments and ideas about the pain. But there also, I could step back and just let the pain be the pain, as opposed to me being the pain. Because what was happening with the pain was I was identifying it quite strongly. I don't know if quite strongly, but I was identifying with it. And as if this was me. And I was watching this and looking at where I was identifying with it, I could see that it's a little bit harder for me. I don't know where you think you are. But, you know, if I think about where I am, I'm in my head. You know, it's kind of like my operating control tower. It's kind of like my right where I think behind my eyes and my head. I don't know, you know, that's where I've associated with. And the headache was the same place. So it was really, you know, it's one thing, I've had pain other places in my body where it's easier to be disidentify with it, not to take it, this is who I am. But the pain, because it was kind of in the same place, it was a little bit harder. So it took a little bit more work to kind of find the place of mindfulness where I could be mindful of it and not be pushed around by it. Be mindful of it and not be entangled with it, not be bothered by it. So, you know, so it took some work. But this ability to have our human capacity to be self-reflective, to be aware, self-aware, can bring us into a place of awareness where we're not oppressed or bothered by what we know. If we don't find this place of free self-reflection, then chances are we're entangled, we're caught, we're involved, we're seeing through the filter of those kinds of, you know, those kinds of feelings and thoughts. And then there's no freedom there. And then we can make foolish decisions, we can be pushed around by things, we are, you know, under the sway of every thought, with our thoughts, our feelings, our reactions we might have. Freedom in Buddhism has a lot to do with not being pushed around by things that we don't want to be pushed around by, particularly our own mind, how our mind functions. So it's possible to have thoughts, deluded thoughts, unattractive thoughts, reactions, responses, and it's possible to just see them there. This is how it is. So an ordinary person is deluded about enlightenment. An enlightened person is enlightened about delusion. So to repeat what I said then, it's really about your own delusion or your own way your mind works. Meaning you're not expected, when you do Buddhist practice, to be a perfect person. You're not expected to be the perfect Buddhist. We have a lot of ideals of how we should be and how things should be. There should be air conditioning. There should be working water. There should not be a headache right now. There's many things that we want to. Many things that we want. We want things to often to be different than how they are, or we want things to stay how they are. We don't want them to change. And so if we are caught in the web of those shoulds and shouldn'ts, how things should be and shouldn't be, it's a recipe for many people to suffer a lot. I shouldn't be this way. Now, one of the interesting questions is, how many people do you know who are perfect? You know, how many, you know, are there a lot of perfect people out there? You know, one way to say is that, yes, they all are. Just like if you look at oak trees. I mean, these oak trees, California kind of oak trees, you know, some of them are pretty gnarly. You know, they kind of, you know, they leave the branches going all ways, they gnarl, and, you know, and they don't look like each other so much. I mean, you kind of recognize them, but it's kind of bizarre the way they grow. I don't think we go around saying that that particular oak tree is not like a perfect oak tree. You know, it's a gnarly oak tree. It's just how it's supposed to be. So that's one way to say people, that people are perfect the way they are. But to do that, to see it that way too much, and to just allow people to be perfect, and allow yourself to be perfect as you are, without any change, then you might just, you know, continue suffering or causing damage in the world. But to see yourself as being not perfect and flawed, I mean, that's also a recipe for a lot of suffering, because that's, for a lot of people, I think that's already the case. there's all kinds of ways which we're not quite up to snuff. You know, there's some, you know, there, I mean, I'm sure you have your own favorite list of your own not quite up to snuff, you know, aspects of who you are. And so is the solution then to make yourself better into a better person, to a perfect person? And so maybe you have to, you know, maybe you need to go to the plastic surgeon, you know, in order to make yourself that perfect person. Or maybe you need to kind of improve your personality, or maybe you need to, I don't know what, but there are all kinds of things we need to do. And some of you come to Buddhism with a little bit the idea that if I do Buddhist practice, then I'll become better, I'll become the perfect person, you know, I'll become, you know, I'll overcome all these problems that I have. But that's not thinking outside the box. That's just kind of living in the world of trying to rearrange the deck chairs in the Titanic. It's just trying to kind of moving things and changing things. There isn't, not that it's wrong to do those things, it's quite helpful to rearrange things and improve oneself. Part of Buddhism is to improve yourself. But the freedom of Buddhism is found not by improving yourself, but by stepping outside the box, stepping outside of thinking, stepping out and using the human capacity for self-reflection, self-awareness, and finding freedom in that self-awareness. And part of that then would be freedom of self-awareness not to identify with anything you see about yourself. Anything you see about yourself, there's no need to take that as this is who I am in some solid, fixed, clear way. It is who you are in a sense, but you don't have to be oppressed by that. You don't have to make anything about it. You don't have to do anything about it. The freedom of awareness, of mindfulness, strong mindfulness that clearly steps back and sees, is the freedom that can see without acting on what you see, acting through what you see. And that's why this mindfulness is such a tremendous help and support in our life, because it gives us the capacity to then choose more wisely how we respond and react. We're not being pushed around by the inner dialogue, the inner life, and what's there. So I offer you this today as something you might consider and try in your life, that perhaps you don't have to change yourself. Perhaps you don't have to improve yourself to be free, but rather you can do that. Zen Master Dogen talks about the backward step, that steps back and away, or the bird's eye view, or that using your self-reflective to see what it is there, and then find how in seeing, how in being mindful and being aware, how in the awareness itself, there is freedom. And if you could find where freedom is found, if you can find freedom in awareness, you'll find a tremendous power in your life. You'll find a tremendous refuge and support for your life. Because then you don't have to change the conditions of the world to be at peace, but rather you can find your peace and freedom in something which is innate in all of us, which is our capacity to be aware. So I hope that made some sense. We have about 15 minutes, and we could take some of that if you have any questions about this or comments you'd like to make.
What did you do about the hotel?
Yeah, well, we came back in the late afternoon, and there was no water still. So we'd been there now for 24 hours. And it was still, we can hope, she said, and Sister Irena. And then she said, oh, but, you know, because we were on the third floor, and she said, oh, but on the first floor there's a shower you could use. So I said, oh, thank you. So she showed me where it was. So my son and I took showers and cooled off, and that was nice. And then by the late evening, the water had come back on. So that was nice. We were there four nights. So the last evening we came back, to the hotel, there was no water. So I went down and talked to her and said, there's no water. And she said, oh. And I wondered whether, does she have this wonderful capacity to, to step back into free awareness and just see things as they are and not react? Or was she being aloof or closed down? And I kind of thought there was some kind of being closed down rather than being free in that attitude. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. But she said, we can hope. And it was clear that she was going to work on it. It wasn't that she was going to pray. But there wasn't, it was clearly we weren't going to have any conversation about it. They were going to do what they were going to do. And then by the time we went to bed, the water was back on. It was in Rome. I grew up in Italy, and half my growing up, and so I wanted to take my 14-year-old son back to Italy and show him where I grew up. So part of the trip with him was to Rome, and so so I found this convent in downtown Rome to stay in. It's kind of nice. Also, part of the reason was I wanted to go someplace where there was no television, no Wi-Fi. Because my son, is a little bit overly involved in that world. And so I wanted to give him a chance to be free of that world for a little while, to kind of see that there's other things to do. So that was part of the motivation to be at the convent.
Gil, you have the mental tools to handle the situation. How did your son respond to the no water and all the heat? And so you're there in a peaceful mode. What's he doing? I'd be going crazy.
I was peaceful because I worked on it. I had to use my mindfulness, right? I don't think he's a little bit at that age. He was just going along with the program. I think he couldn't sleep the first night, and he wanted to have, but I think at his age, he's just going along. He didn't have any idea that it should be any different. He didn't have, he showed up there, and there's nuns, right? I just told him we're going to a hotel in Rome, right? So he thought that was kind of noticed it was not quite a conventional hotel, but. He just went along with the program. I think he'd probably complain if I took him back. Yeah.
So this last couple of weeks, I've been actually doing the practice you've been describing, not because I wanted to, but because we've been remodeling our kitchen. And about the month before, when I was dealing with all the contractors, I started having a lot of physical symptoms that I attributed to a disease condition I have. And so I didn't make any connection between it, and I was seeing the doctors, And about the time the tests came back, just before that, my mind started kind of waking up to, maybe this isn't my body, maybe this is my mind's reaction to the anxiety about the kitchen. And just that waking up to that, the mind started to, it wasn't like I was, a bad person. It was more, hey, maybe I should think about this differently, And then I'd notice when the body started doing its thing, I said, maybe we should try breathing deeply, And it was amazing. The symptoms went away. It was like, wow, I can actually do this if I'm awake enough to know that I have that option. But it was that waking up that took 3 weeks. But
it's wonderful. So the trick is to remember to wake up more often.
Yeah, the first thing that hit me was, wait a minute, I've been doing this practice so long. Wasn't able to do that? And this happened 3 times in 3 different ways over the past however long we've called kitchen dukkha has been going on. And I finally came to the conclusion of pretty much what you were saying, that at least where I am in the practice, my practice isn't preventing me from getting into dukkha stuff, but it is finally giving me tools to help me get out when I wake up to it. And I would like it to like start diminishing the dukkha stuff, but...
It does. It does diminish too. Thank you very much. Over here, I see over here.
My husband and I just came back from a vacation, and I found the place we were going to stay on the internet. And then I did long story short, I figured it all out that we were going to fly into this one town, and then it would be 70 miles to drive where we were supposed to go based on MapQuest. And that wasn't true at all. And not only that, but it was, you know, way further than what the MapQuest direction said. The state was building a highway. This was in Wyoming. And expanding the road so that there would be enough room for wild animals and cars. And it was literally being dug, you know, as we were there. So we drove to this place, and then our car stopped. And we just sat there, and I was so agitated when I think back about it. And what happened was they would only let one side of the road go first, and they had to be led, and that took about 20, 25 minutes. So you're sitting there not knowing, and you're looking out, and you're standing, you're getting out of the car, and you're wondering what's going on. That was me. Not you. That was me. And then once I learned that that was the fact, I was able to surrender. And so every day we had to drive many miles just to get to the main road to get to where we wanted to go. So it was an additional. And I just, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, there was day one. It was like if there was like a sort of a montage of me in that experience. And by day four, it took that long. Well, no, actually it didn't. It took by day three. I found an NPR station way up in the mountains that played this great music. You know, they had that was the hour. It was the hour of all this eclectic music. And I actually looked forward to it. You know, we'd stop the car, sit there for about 20 minutes, and find the station. So, you know, it was really an experience of surrendering. And I think that's partly what you're talking about. You know, surrendering rather than being at the effect of, you know, it almost turned into despair. That's how, you know, that's how much the flypaper I stuck to, or, you know, how much... How sticky that flypaper was. Anyway, thanks.
Some things, we have to surrender to some things which are inevitable. There's some things we can't change. And so the wisdom of knowing when it's time to surrender, and then the delight, the joy that's available when we're no longer caught up in our machinations. Great story. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, so when you were talking about flypaper, for me, it's just, I guess, fear. You know, I can get really, really stuck in fear, and it's gotten in the way for me a lot. I've been unemployed for about 6 months, and so 3 months ago I started meditating with the definite desire to get some relief. You know, I definitely wanted to, in a way, improve myself that way, you know. And I've gotten some sense of what freedom can taste like, you know, and I've gotten a sense that I have a little bit of I don't know if control is the right word, but I have improved myself in the way that I'm better able to deal with that fear. So now I have this opportunity for a new job, and I'm starting tomorrow, but it's going to be on the graveyard shift. So now I'm dealing with that fear because that's going to turn my life upside down. And so again, I'm hoping that it's going to help me improve myself, so at least I can just deal with it and not be stuck, you know. And I feel like it is helping, but sometimes that sense that, you know, honestly, when I am meditating, I am doing it for a reason, and that can become another entanglement.
It can be. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. It's fine to improve oneself, you know, but just there are a lot of traps involved in that as well. Something like fear, like what you're talking about, I think it's, I mean, all the emotions, fear, anger, all these things, joy, compassion, love, I think it's really helpful to relate to them with respect. Be respectful of them. Don't be dismissive. Don't be angry that they're there. Be respectful of them. And it's really helpful to find this place of freedom, free awareness, to see it, step back and just know, here I'm afraid, this is what it's like. But not to use that, it's a kind of a power to do that, a kind of strength to be able to do that. It's possible to abuse that strength by then being dismissive of the fear. And so once you find your freedom with it, then you might actually also study it a little bit more carefully, because maybe there's something important to be learned there in being afraid. Because when you said, you know, you're going to turn your life upside down by doing it the night shift, maybe there are important things to pay attention to in that shift, and maybe the fear can point to you some real issues that need to be addressed. Yes.
Gil, thank you again for another great talk. I hope I'll be able to articulate my query. When you're faced with the challenging situation, I'm just wondering, what is the aspect of awareness that you're aware of to counter the unpleasant situation, the challenge, the irritation, the source of the irritation? Are you aware of your objective, which is germane? Well, I don't know what your objective in the situation is, or what you're aware of. Is it maintaining control, or probably not? But the idea of freedom. I mean, I know you've mentioned the spirit, or the freedom and peace. Is there anything else that counters? Are you aware of something that counters?
Sometimes. I mean, sometimes you can be calm or peaceful, and the calm or the tranquility or the love or the compassion or whatever, it can be strong enough that it does work as a kind of a ballast, so we're not pushed around so much, or it puts everything in a bigger context. But what I was trying to say today in terms of mindfulness practice, this approach, would be not so much to rely on that and focus on that, but to just keep being more mindful, be mindful of what's actually happening. So if the peace is there, then great. But if there's no peace, don't try to make it, don't try to focus on it. But rather, the question always is, what's really going on right now? And to look more carefully, what's happening here? And that careful looking at what's happening now, at your reaction, response to the situation, if you do it strong enough or consistently enough, then at some point you'll find yourself becoming more free from the situation. You won't be so caught and entangled by it. And then you can be, in terms of what you can focus on that's helpful, is you can, at some point you can become, focus on how mindfulness helps you be a little bit independent of what you're knowing. That ability kind of being pulled out of the situation. It's kind of pulled away from the flypaper, or the classic Buddhist analogy is no longer sinking in the mud, but you're up on dry land. You can feel the difference of being pulled out of the mud. Does that make some sense? To repeat it then, it's to keep looking, look more carefully, what's actually going on right now? And so what's actually happening now? What am I feeling? What am I thinking? What's the situation? Just keep looking. And not be blinded or sidetracked by ideals, what it should be or what could be. If there's peace as part of it, what's going on now, then that can be a resource for you. But the idea is the dedication is to see what's actually happening now. And then as we see what's happening now, it's the seeing that gets stronger, the seeing. So it's not a matter of, one of the little sayings in our scene, that mindfulness is not about seeing something new, it's about seeing in a new way. So some people are always looking for the new thing, the key, the solution. Where am I going to find something that's going to fix everything? But rather, we have to look and see, but we're hopefully seeing in a new way. So we see in such a way that we're not caught, not entangled. It's like stepping outside the box. So I hope that was clear enough.
Thank you.
Okay. So maybe one more. So I don't know who was next, but...
Thank you. I too am really benefiting from this talk and thinking about being in the moment and what precedes the moment, the continuity of the stories, whether it's commute time or general contractor in our home or accessibility to water. Right before being in the moment, there's an expectation of, and I'm wondering about working with the unconscious expectation that I carry with me when I get in my car and go to work, or
that's a good one.
Do you try to address, because I must have 10,000.
Yes.
Do you try to ever, do you work with them when you're crossing the threshold of the convent before you meet the mirror?
Yes and no. The yes part is, I think, is really good regularly check in. What's the attitude? What's the intention? What are the expectations? What are the beliefs I bring with me to this situation? And to be cognizant of it doesn't necessarily mean that they should be jettisoned, but they might be useful ideas. But to say, what attitudes do I have here? And but you can't do it all. You can't go through the inventory, right? It had never would have occurred to me that, you know, there was not going to be a water. If I'd gone through all my expectations that I possibly could have had, you know, that I would have never made it to the convent. So, you know, some things you have to deal with as they come up, even though you had a kind of preconceived ideas about it. But yes, I think it's really good to ask that question. What do I bring with me in important junctions in life? Going to see someone, going to work, going to a different situation. What am I bringing with me? What are my attitudes? What are my approaches? What are the moods that I'm bringing with me?
I am reminded of that statement that the path is easier if one has no preferences. And the path to having no preferences, which is like no expectations, is I understand better how to work with something in the moment, how to see the my personal issues coming up when I'm without that which I expected, better than to have no preferences.
You to see it. Yeah, I don't think it's reasonable for human beings to have no preferences.
So. Oh, thank you.
And but if the mindfulness is strong enough, we can see the preference and not be pushed around by it, not be caught by it. Say, oh, I have a preference, but you know, it doesn't have to be that way. Okay, so thank you all very much.